This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
I don't think there's any evidence I've been co-opted by anyone, and I think that that's an ad hominem tactic people use to not address really the important conversations we're having here.
But he also says you must include race.
No, he didn't. He says it's
yes, he does.
Okay, well, everyone should go read the book Why We Can't Wait. And what Martin Luther King wrote in his book Why We Can't Wait is he called it, we need a Bill of Rights for the Disadvantaged.
As you are a student of Dr. King, I'm not only a student of Dr. King, I know his daughter, Bernice.
So Coleman Hughes just bodied his appearance on The View, where he went on to defend his view of racial colorblindness at a table nearly full of people who disagree with him. Let's react.
Yeah, you better. Yeah, you better.
All right, guys, before we get into this video, big shout out to my patrons on Patreon for fueling the work I do on this channel. I try to keep those host read ads off of this channel for your sake and mine. So thank you for supporting. So as I said before, Coleman Hughes recently appeared on The View to talk about a book that he put out called The End of Race Politics, Arguments for a Colorblind America. And as you can imagine, The View is not the best audience for this kind of message. You have Whoopi Goldberg, Joy Behar, Sonny Hostin, all of whom have particularly left-leaning views they are not afraid to espouse and go back and forth with you on. So let's see how Coleman Hughes defends his thesis in this interview. Let's go.
First question that I should ask you to do is explain to folks what you mean by this. Arguments for a colorblind America. What do you mean when you say that?
So a lot of people equate colorblindness to I don't see race mm-hmm. or to pretending not to see race. Mm-hmm. I think that's a big mistake. We all see race, mm-hmm. right? And we're all capable of being racially biased, so we should all be self-aware to that possibility. My argument is not for that. My argument is that we should try our very best to treat people without regard to race, both in our personal lives and our public policy.
Of course.
And the reason I wrote this book, thank you.
So it's interesting. Of course, Coleman just eloquently stated what his view of colorblindness is, not that we don't see race, because of course we see race. You guys know what I look like. I know what you look like when I see you guys in person. But we just don't want to take that too much into account when we're judging how to treat one another, especially legislatively. And you hear Joy Behar in the background sort of say, of course, which is interesting because clearly what Coleman is saying sounds rational, but these ladies also love things like affirmative action and talking about reparations, which is treatment based on race when we really boil it down to its essence. So it's interesting that so far we're hearing some agreement. I'm wondering if we're gonna get, you know, toe-to-toe on some of the deeper issues and why Joy Behar's agreement might not be what she thinks it is.
The reason I wrote this book is because in the past 10 years, it has become very popular to, in the name of anti-racism, mm-hmm. teach a kind of philosophy to our children and in general that says your race is everything, right? And I think that is the wrong way to fight racism, and that's why I wrote this book at this time.
Can I just point out that there is a reason for that? You know, when I went to school, getting any information about anyone's race was not taught. In history, there was no black history. None of those things were taught. And here in America, 100 years ago, when I was a young woman, that's how people saw you. That's how they judged you. So I think, I don't want to say it's your youth, but I think you have a point, but I think you have to also take into consideration what people have lived through in order to understand why there has been such a pointing of very specific racial things, like women couldn't go to get into colleges. If you are a black person, there are a lot of colleges wouldn't accept you. Trying to equal the playing field. I think that's what a lot of folks have been trying to do. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
I think that's your experience, and that's valid. You know, as a counterpoint, mm-hmm. when I was in fifth grade, we all watched Roots mm-hmm. together.
Yeah.
In public school.
Yeah.
So these are different experiences.
Yes.
I think it's also different generations. Mm-hmm. It's different parts of the country, mm-hmm. right? We have very different cultures all living together in one
yes.
country. So I'm not going to deny that. But I think I view this notion of a colorblind society similar to the idea of a peaceful society, which is to say it's an ideal. It's a North Star.
Mm-hmm.
And the point is not that we're ever going to get there. We're not going to touch it. But we have to know when we're going forward and when we're going backwards. And we're going backwards when we're doing woke kindergarten in San Francisco.
Okay, love the response. And there is something masterful about the way he just responded to Whoopi Goldberg by not starting off with a defense or starting off with her criticism of his statement, but instead validating the experience that she expressed having lived through in the United States of America and saying, you know what, since then, we've made changes. We've done what we think is a progressive move towards solving some of these problems. But I want to challenge the idea that what we've done is actually progressive. He thinks it's regressive. Instead of focusing on past discrimination and fixing it with present discrimination, which is what we're doing, we should have discussions about past discrimination, talk about why that was wrong, and live that in our reality. If we discriminate in response to the past transgressions in U.S. history and in America, we're committing the same wrong. And in fact, we are regressing. And that's how you'll see we've sort of moved backwards. And a lot of the things that we're seeing today really feel like old school Jim Crow segregation when you have, you know, black owned business sections or you see black creations on Netflix and Hulu. And you can give any example for any, you know, race of color now where we are choosing to divide amongst ourselves instead of appreciating the fact that we've come to a time of progress where we no longer need to do that anymore. So we'll see how Whoopi responds, if she responds, but I have a feeling we're going to move on and move on quickly. And since you didn't get to speak to the woke kindergarten story, there was a school in California that spent $250,000 on a program called Woke Kindergarten. And this really involved teaching the students about race and gender and sexuality and protesting and all these different things that are now being ushered into education as a means of raising test scores. Now, ask yourself, do you think that it raised the test scores of the students who underwent this program? It did not, but there was $250,000 down the drain, and now students who are educated in what would be, you know, peak leftist agenda, which also involves a major focus on race. Now, let's keep watching.
You didn't hear about this story?
No, but wait, because I want to get to the part of the book.
Yeah, okay, do you actually believe that public policies that address socioeconomic differences would be better at benefiting disadvantaged groups, and that race-based policies often hurt the very people they're trying to help. What are some examples of policies that would be better at reducing racial disparities?
So my overall argument is that class, socioeconomics, is a better proxy for disadvantage. We all want to help the disadvantaged, and the question is, how do we identify them, right? The default right now in a lot of areas of policy is to use, you know, black and Hispanic identity as a proxy for disadvantage. And my argument is that you actually get a better picture of who needs help by looking at socioeconomics and income. Mm-hmm. That picks out people in a more accurate way.
Well, right. Not my question, but when you say that socioeconomics picks out people in a better way than mm-hmm. race, mm-hmm. when you do look at the socioeconomics, you see the huge disparity between white households and black households. You see the huge disparity between white households and Hispanic households. So your argument, and I've read your book twice because I wanted to give it a chance, your argument that race has no place in that equation is really fundamentally flawed, in my opinion.
Ooh, there's such condescension in the way that she's speaking to him, but we'll get into that in a little bit.
There's two separate questions. One is whether each racial group is socioeconomically the same. I agree with you.
They're not.
I agree with that fully. The question is, how do you address that in the way that actually targets poverty the best?
Great.
And what Martin Luther King wrote in his book, Why We Can't Wait, mm-hmm. is he called it, we need a Bill of Rights for the disadvantaged. Mm-hmm. And he said, yes, we should address racial inequality. Yes, right. we should address the legacy of slavery. But the way to do that is on the basis of class. And that will disproportionately target blacks and Hispanics because they're disproportionately poor, but it will be doing so in a way that also helps the white poor, in a way that addresses poverty as the thing to be addressed.
100%. And I just want to speak to Sunny Hostin's energy for a little bit here. She is clearly coming at him from a point of condescension. I read your book twice because, you know, I really wanted to give it a chance, but I feel as though it's fundamentally flawed. And you can sort of tell when he's answering her question, she's rolling forward, just ready to just pounce and jump on him at any moment she gets the chance, which sort of signals to me that she's not exactly listening to the argument that he's making. Or if she is listening, she's listening to respond rather than to understand. And that's clearly the energy that she's giving off throughout her time talking to Coleman on this subject matter. Now, let's get into socioeconomic status versus race. It's very true. There is a big disparity when it comes to socioeconomics when you compare black people to white people or Hispanic people to white people. And that's something that we can acknowledge and talk about. But what Coleman is advocating is that we actually look at class when it comes to solving problems. So much of what we say are issues that face the black community. Let's see, a lack of resources, lack of two-parent households, lack of proper education. That affects all people of lower classes, regardless of race. So why focus on the black element rather than focusing on that tier of the class structure, which would end up helping everybody and lifting everybody up? A big thought experiment we can do here, or I guess a small one, would be to look at Sunny Hostin, Whoopi Goldberg, and Coleman themselves. They are all of black descent, but they're not struggling with resources. They're not struggling with education, and they're not in a class tier that is particularly struggling. But because they all qualify as being black, should they now be helped with these black-focused programs? Probably not. But we can help underprivileged black kids who are in a lower class tier, as well as the white, Hispanic, Indigenous, and Asian kids who are there with them. It doesn't make any sense to focus on race itself, and I hope that lands with Sunny Hostin in this conversation, but I do have a strong feeling that it won't.
That part is true, but as you are a student of Dr. King, I'm not only a student of Dr. King, I know his daughter, Bernice, right? Mm. So I'm going to get to my question.
Go ahead, go right ahead.
I think the premise is fundamentally flawed. You claim that color blindness was the goal of the civil rights movement, mm-hmm. based upon Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech, you know, content of character versus the color of skin. Bernice, Dr. King's daughter, points out that 4 years after giving that speech, actually, Dr. King also said this: a society that has done something special against the Negro for hundreds of years must now do something special for Negroes. He also said in 1968, it was about less than a week before he was assassinated, this country never stops to realize that they owe a people kept in slavery for 244 years. So rather than class, he did write about that earlier on, right before his death. He made the argument for racial equality and racial reparations. And
it's interesting that she's saying that he made the case for racial equality when what she's describing in her personal view of politics is racial equity. And these two things are very, very different. So I don't think that she is all that well rehearsed when it comes to what she's advocating for and really juxtaposing that with the words of Martin Luther King. And again, I do have a strong feeling that she sort of cherry picked some quotes from Martin Luther King that she felt would fly in the face of some of the things that Coleman would say during this interview, and she's probably not well enough prepared for the intellect that is Coleman sitting across from her. She thinks this may be a gotcha moment where he sort of realizes, oh, maybe I've been quoting Martin Luther King wrong, and I don't think that's gonna happen.
And so your argument for color blindness, I think, is something that the right has co-opted. And so many in the black community, if I'm being honest with you, because I want to be, believe that you are being used as a pawn by the right, and that you're a charlatan of sorts.
He's not a Republican. Wow.
So how do you?
He's never voted for a Republican.
You've said that you're a conservative.
No,
you did. You actually said that in the podcast that you did 2 weeks ago.
I said I was a conservative.
Yes, you did. So, but my question to you, is, how do you respond to those critics?
Okay, let's give him an answer.
First thing, I think it's very important. The quote that you just pointed out about doing something special for the Negro, that's from the book Why We Can't Wait that I just mentioned.
Yes.
A couple paragraphs later, he lays out exactly what that something special was, yes. And it was the Bill of Rights for the Disadvantaged, a broad class-based policy.
But he also says you must include race.
No, he didn't. He says it's
he does.
Okay, well, everyone should go read the book Why We Can't Wait. Let's not get sidetracked by that.
Yeah.
I don't think I've been co-opted by anyone. I've only voted twice, both for Democrats. Mm-hmm. Although I'm an independent, I would vote for a Republican, mm-hmm. probably a non-Trump Republican if they were compelling. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any evidence I've been co-opted by anyone, and I think that that's an ad hominem tactic people use to not address really the important conversations we're having here. And I think it's better, and it would be better for everyone if we stuck to the topics rather than make it about me.
I want to give you the opportunity to respond to the criticism.
I appreciate it.
Okay, interesting. So there's several games being played, and Coleman is choosing not to engage in the games, which is really interesting. And I want to focus more on the structure of the debate that's happening right now rather than what's being said, because I feel like he's clearing up the issues on his own. You guys don't need me to retell you what he just said. But she tries to come after him with these sort of gotcha quotes that she's collected, not recognizing that he would very much be ready for the quotes and, in fact, be able to reference paragraphs that follow the very quotes that she's brought on. Then, instead of standing by her own criticism of Coleman Hughes, which is that she believes that he is a charlatan that is co-opted by the right, she decides to package that by saying, this is what other people think of you, if I'm being honest, which I want to be. And when that is sort of combated, and he says, you know, this is by no means true, there's in fact no evidence to justify this claim, she walks back and says, well, it's not my opinion. I just wanted to share the criticism that other people have for you. And he didn't allow her to even go back and forth on the issue of what was written in the book. I love that he just said, you know what, this is actually not in fact what we're here to argue about. I'm not here to argue about what Dr. King said. I'm here to share my own arguments, and your audience and yourself can go and read that book at your leisure to fill yourself in and see which conclusion you draw. Very masterful, and good on him for staying calm.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Welcome to the Snapple Market Auditory Experience. Close your eyes. Imagine you're walking into your neighborhood store. You make your way to the back and reach for your favorite Snapple flavor. You can't wait. You take a sip. Whoa, that's a lot of flavor. What flavor are you holding? Now open your eyes and check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavorful Snapple near you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
There's no evidence that I've been co-opted by anyone. I have an independent podcast. Mm-hmm. I work for CNN as an analyst. Mm-hmm. I write for the Free Press. I'm independent in all of these endeavors, and no one is paying me to say what I'm saying. I'm saying it because I feel it.
Yes. Alyssa, you have the question.
Coleman, thanks for being here. So in the past decade, it feels like racial tensions have gotten worse. Do you see it that way, and what do you attribute it to?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at all the data, it finds that race relations were getting better until about 2013. That year, you had majority of Black, Hispanic, and white Americans saying race relations were good. And then you just see it nosedive. And 2013, you know, people like to blame, Republicans like to blame Obama. Wasn't his fault. Democrats like to blame Trump. It was actually just technology. We all got social media and smartphones, and we had videos being promoted in the algorithm that were unrepresentative, and it created this impression that racism was on the rise when, in fact, it had been on the decline for decades.
And it allowed
everybody. Do you attribute that at all to foreign actors getting involved in technology?
Yes, Russia tries to meddle, absolutely, but I don't think we can blame foreign actors. Mm-hmm. This is a homegrown problem.
Okay.
Yeah, a great example of this very thing is, think about police brutality. In the age where we were all discussing police brutality, there were videos after videos after videos circulating all over the internet of these incidences, and where you would interview people on the street and say, you know, how many unarmed black men do you think are killed by police officers each year? People were saying hundreds. Others were saying thousands, and it's because the internet gave that impression, because these videos are circulating, people are sharing them, they're sharing vitriolic statements, hatred towards police officers, saying that this is a much bigger issue than in fact it is. This is not to say that it's not an issue whatsoever. It's just to say that it was magnified in the lens of social media, when in reality, you're looking at a handful of individuals who ended up losing their lives who were unarmed black men. I think anywhere from, 19 to 25 in a typical year. So this is what happens. Social media can exacerbate our feelings and convince us of a reality that is in fact not the reality. And the way that algorithms work and the way that social media is programmed does exactly that. It sort of feeds you an endless loop of whatever strikes a chord with you, whatever brings about a visceral reaction and whatever you engage with. So things are going to be magnified for you. And I'm sure you guys can think of your own examples of things that are not even political that have been magnified under the lens of social media for you that may not be a true depiction of reality.
I have a question, because you write that the anti-racism movement, there are a couple of people, I don't even know who they are, maybe.
Robin DiAngelo,
yeah. Ibram Kendi, for instance.
Okay. Well, you say that that is just a form of another form of racism, and you even say it has a lot in common with white supremacy. How can you compare those two things?
Interesting. Sorry, I keep pausing this. But I don't want to oversimplify their viewpoints on these issues, but I do think there is a group of people who hear the phrase white supremacy and hear the phrase anti-racist and think, just because of the way those two phrases sound, that they could not possibly have anything in common. Well, the term is anti-racist, which by definition means I'm not racist. How could I have anything in common with a white supremacist when I identify as an anti-racist? But when you truly look into the ideology, which I hope Coleman is going to explain, there are tons of similarities that should signal to you that we are not moving in the right directions when it comes to race politics and race relations here in the U.S. and abroad, honestly.
You're talking about anti-racism, you're comparing it to white supremacy.
Mm-hmm. Because they both view your race as an extremely significant part of who you are. So white supremacists, they obviously say, we all know what they say, okay? Neo-racists like Rob DiAngelo, they say that to be white is to be ignorant, for example. Uh-huh. Well, this is a racial stereotype, and I want to call a spade and say this is not the style of anti-racism we have to be teaching our kids. We should be teaching them that your race is not a significant feature of you, who you are. Who you are is your character, your value, and your skin color doesn't say anything about that.
That's actually misrepresenting what Robin DiAngelo's position is.
It's in her book.
But here we go. Thank you.
It is in her book. And I'll have to remind you, right? Robin DiAngelo's, her book is called White Fragility. So she is, in fact, promoting a racial stereotype within the very title of her book. And Robin DiAngelo is doing this as a white person. So, I mean, it's abundantly clear what her stance is on the issue in regard to race. And it is that white people sort of carry not only this innate privilege, but an innate racism that follows them throughout life and an unconscious bias that they can express at any given moment. And this is a shared belief amongst the Robin DiAngelos, Ibram X. Kendis, and the critical race theorists of the world, which again sounds very similar to ideas expressed by those who identify as white supremacists. Just, you know, flipping out the colors, essentially, is what's happening here. But let's see how they close out and if they give him any more time to speak.
Coleman Hughes for coming. Because this is a show of lots of different opinions, and mm-hmm. we are multi-generational, and we all got an opinion. Yeah. So, the end of race politics, arguments for a colorblind America is out now, and we're giving it to you all, so you can read it and judge for yourself how you feel about what he said.
That is funny. We are begrudgingly giving you a copy of this book. So read it if you want to read it. It's so funny that they couldn't find a way to even compliment his intellect. Like, they can't find a way to compliment the intellect of somebody that they disagree with. So Whoopi said, we all have opinions. We're all different people, and we all, I guess we all have opinions. I really want to know what's going through Coleman's mind during this entire back and forth, and how he felt after it happened. Did he feel like it was a successful exchange? It was clearly a successful exchange on his part. I also want to know what was going through the mind of the audience, because the audience, you could tell, was going in and out of applause. They were applauding Sonny Hostin, then applauding something Coleman said, even though the two different statements sort of flew in the face of one another and contradicted one another. Maybe it's different audience members clapping for different things, but there was a clear tension that you could sort of feel, where people are maybe thinking through what they're hearing and wondering which side to support. And I think more people are going to have to go through that and contend with some of the ideas that they have today. I am very honestly surprised to see that Coleman Hughes was invited on The View to have this discussion, and I'm glad he was, even though not many of them agreed with what he had to say. Maybe a couple of the panelists did. I'm glad that they brought him in the room so that he could share his opinions, and hopefully it resonated with people, and people are going to go on to read the book and think about what are arguments for a colorblind America. You all know that I second the argument. I think colorblindness and race neutrality is our best chance at a flourishing and prosperous future. But those are just my thoughts. Drop your thoughts in the comments down below. I'd love to hear from those of you who disagree with me, of course. So if you disagree, duke it out in the comments down below, but do so respectfully. And if you like this video, like, subscribe, click the notification bell to be notified every single time I post a video for you guys, which is every day. And I will see you next time. Bye, guys. Yeah, you better. Yeah, you better.